This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. An aid ship loaded with some 200 tons of food for Gaza has set sail for Cyprus and should arrive in about 3 days. More on the attempts to deliver that aid from Reuters' Lucy Fielder.
The aid ship was funded mostly by the UAE and organized by US-based charity World Central Kitchen, with much of Gaza reduced to rubble. WCK said it was building a landing jetty with material from destroyed buildings. Open Arms spokesperson Laura Lanuza.
There has been a naval blockade from Israel since over 20 years ago. So for us, makes us really, really happy and proud.
Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson Majid al-Ansari said on Tuesday negotiators seeking a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas were not close to a deal. There'd been hopes for a truce in time for Ramadan, which began this week.
That is Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. Yemen's Houthi rebels have targeted a Liberian-flagged container ship in the Red Sea with missiles on Monday, producing an explosion near the vessel but causing no damage. Uncertainty over Haiti's political future on Tuesday after its prime minister said he would step down, a move welcomed by many Haitians, exhausted by months of escalating gang violence, but with questions over security still to be settled. Reuters' Emma Jelly.
Kenya's government did an about-face on Tuesday, announcing it was pausing a long-delayed deployment of Kenyan police officers to tackle spiraling violence in Haiti. Only 11 days ago, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry and Kenyan President William Ruto signed an agreement that Ruto said would fast-track the deployment of the officers to the Caribbean nation. The jarring turn of events leaves the future of the UN-backed multinational mission for Haiti in serious doubt. Kenya's government first pledged 1,000 officers to lead the security mission last July, but the initiative had been tied up in court challenges ever since.
This is VOA News. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports on Tuesday incursions and casualties in fighting between Russia and Ukraine.
Ukrainian officials say long-range drones smashed into two oil facilities deep inside Russia on Tuesday. The attack by waves of drones across eight regions of Russia displayed Kyiv's expanding technological capacity as the war extends into its third year. And a cross-border ground assault also weakened President Vladimir Putin's argument that life in Russia has been unaffected by the war. Kyiv officials say the soldiers are Russian volunteers fighting for Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry says its military and security forces killed 234 fighters while thwarting the incursion. I'm Norman Hall.
Both the Biden administration said Tuesday that the United States will send a new military aid package for Ukraine. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has those details.
The newly announced military aid package for Ukraine is worth $300 million and is the first such move in months as additional funds for Kyiv remain blocked by Republican leaders in Congress. The White House has been scrambling to find ways to send more military assistance given the situation on the battlefield and the resistance to the funding from Republican hardliners. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the funding was coming from unanticipated cost savings from Pentagon contracts that would be used for artillery rounds and munitions for high-mobility artillery rocket systems. Sullivan added that this ammunition will keep Ukraine's guns firing for a period, but only a short period. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have won enough delegates to be called presumptive presidential nominees. While Biden and Trump were the last remaining major candidates for their party's 2024 presidential nominations, the Associated Press only uses the designation presumptive nominee once a candidate has captured the number of delegates needed to win a majority vote at the national party conventions over the summer. Biden reached that point after he won Tuesday's Georgia primary and enough at the state's delegates to put him above 1,968 needed for the nomination. Trump also clinched Tuesday, winning in Georgia and Mississippi before victory in Washington put him over the 1,215 delegates needed. U.S. lawmakers are threatening to ban TikTok, but also say that they are giving its Chinese parent company a chance to keep it running. The premise of a bipartisan bill headed for a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives is that TikTok fans in the U.S. can keep scrolling through their favorite social media app so long as Beijing-based ByteDance gives up owning it. But it's not going to be as simple as lawmakers are making it sound, according to experts. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today Break Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jen Barty, Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 13th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya delays the deployment of at least 1,000 police officers to Haiti to fight gang violence.
We have a regime that we regard to have a very high appetite for money, so we expect that they are going to still continue to look for a way to do this so that they can get the money.
The Secretary General of the East African Legislative Assembly is accused of corruption. Sudan's army says it has taken control of the national radio and television headquarters in the city of Umdurma. A Turkey-Somalia maritime deal projects Turkey's growing naval power but provokes regional tensions. Burundi's main opposition leader plans to return home days after he was ousted as a party leader.
I must be back in Burundi. That's my motherland, and it's my right to live in my mother country. Who can say you are no longer a Burundian, and for what reason?
And Botswana communities march against the United Kingdom's anti-hunting bill. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya says it is delaying the planned deployment of at least 1,000 police officers to Haiti to fight gang violence. This follows an announcement by Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry that he will resign. Kenya's principal secretary at the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Kori Singoi, was quoted Tuesday as saying there had been a fundamental change in circumstances in Haiti because of the complete breakdown of law and order there. Kenya's constitutional lawyer, Paul Mwingi, tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that despite all the hurdles, the Kenyan government may still deploy in the island nation.
Firstly, from a constitutional point of view, we had said that the Kenyan constitution does not allow the situation that is there. The point is that the constitution of Kenya allows us to send a military as part of peacekeeping forces, but does not allow the police to be involved in such an engagement unless there is a bilateral treaty. We do not have a bilateral treaty with Haiti, and the reason why the Haiti Prime Minister had come is to correct that legal and constitutional lacuna that was existing. So even before the fact that he's out of office, there was no constitutional or legal foundation for sending our policemen to Haiti. But secondly, now that there is no government in Haiti, again, the expectation had been that once we have signed our agreement that we would now enter into a treaty, because the law and the constitution requires there to be a treaty. What we had was an understanding, but we had not gone through the treaty-making process. So even as we stand now, regardless of the agreement, we still have no constitutional or legal foundation for this mission.
Legal aspects aside, there are those who have argued even if there had been one, it would be a big task for the Kenyan troops, given that they don't speak the language, they don't know the area, and now that there's no government in place, that should be not very safe for them. Do you agree to that assertion?
First, we have two problems. One is political, because we view the action by the president to say that he will send a Kenyan police to Haiti to keep law and order as hypocritical. We see it like a laugh in our face because we are undergoing very serious insecurity incidences in the country, in the north, where there is a perpetual state of disorder with people being killed by bandits. So, firstly, we find it very hypocritical that we could be talking about going to assist another country. But secondly, we also find it very ignorant because the true position in Haiti is that no country wants to send their troops there. America itself does not want to send its troops there. So we do not know why Kenyan policemen are being sent. We feel as if we are being used as cannon fodder for an engagement that is not in our national interest.
So in a word or two, the mission may have flopped now.
We think it has flopped, but we, knowing our government, we believe that they will continue to look for any means to get this done, largely because there is a question of some 14 billion shillings that we were promised. And we having a regime that we regard to have a very high appetite for money, so we expect that they are going to still continue to look for a way to do this so that they can get the money.
Kenyan constitutional lawyer Paul Mwenge, he spoke from Nairobi with my colleague Douglas Mpuga. Sudan's army announced on Tuesday it had taken control of the national radio and television headquarters in the city of Omdurman after heavy fighting with the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. Reuters quotes an army spokesperson as saying the seizure liberated the memory and conscience of the Sudanese nation from the RSF. However, the RSF released a video late Tuesday showing they were still in control of the radio and television station. Ibrahim Hamza is a journalist and researcher in Khartoum. He tells me that while some Sudanese are happy about seizing the station, others say it has very little impact on the war.
The conflict about radio and TV headquarters in Omdurman between the Sudanese army and RSF started like a week ago. And last night, there is a very heavy shooting from the army there. And today, afternoon, Sudan time, the army took control and seized this building. This is the news we have so far. Some news says that there is some army prisoners seized by RSF there, but this is not true. Some civilians are happy about that, and they are like feeling like joy about the army took control of this headquarters. In the other hand, this control means nothing, has no importance, because if there is a military coup, yeah, it will be like important, because all the previous military coup, the army announced its control over Sudan through this radio and TV radio station. But now the situation in the ground has changed, so this control now has no any value for the army.
This is the month of Ramadan. How are Sudanese in Khartoum celebrating the month of Ramadan in the midst of this war?
Actually, Sudanese now received this Ramadan this year in a very, very difficult situation because of the war, because of the poverty, because of the lack of everything. The main services like water, electricity, how to access the medical centers, everything. Actually, it is very, very difficult. In addition to that, in Khartoum, especially also Ramadan in the month of March, even the weather is very, 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 very hot. So Sudanese now are receiving the month of Ramadan this time in very, very, very horrible and very, very difficult situation in Khartoum and in the other parts of Sudan as well.
Ibrahim Hamza is a journalist and researcher in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The leader of Burundi's main opposition party, the National Freedom Council, CNL, says he will return to Burundi as soon as possible because the country needs his contribution to national development. Agathon Rwasa left Burundi over the weekend for Tanzania when a faction of the CNL announced his removal for allegedly failing to unify the party. Rwasa tells me that democracy is at stake and that the international community must help to prevent the worst from happening.
You know, we are in a banana republic somehow. Minister for Home Affairs manipulated some and pretend that they organize a national convention. But according to the rules of our party, only the president of the party or his secretary general can call for a national convention. It is just a game they are trying to play, but which proves enough that democracy is at stake and that everyone must stay alert and help prevent the worst in that Burundi. Because if chaos would once again come into that land, I don't know what should be the outcome. Will we just be like Haiti or what? We don't wish that to happen. That's why we have appealed to each and everyone to try its best to use its influence on this one or that other one to make sure that Burundians, mostly CNL members, can enjoy our rights as citizens and as Burundians.
They have accused you of failing to unify the party. Your comment?
Why should we try to divide our party and then pretend that I am against the unity of the party? We fought about a meeting where everybody was invited. That minister refused. This was in August. And lastly, we convened for a national convention. The same minister refused. We have a letter for that. And how can he go on with his puppets, pretend that he's the one for the unity of the party? First of all, mingling within internal matters of the party in order to thwart it, divide it, is a proof that he's against the unity of Burundians and mostly against a strong CNL, a united CNL. That's why he's moving forward to try to weaken CNL by dividing it.
Mr. Raza, you know, Burundi holds election next year. Can you form another party to contest the election?
I think that won't be the better way to fight against this dictatorship of Burundi. 2025, the CNDD-FDD is aware that Burundians are fed up with its mal-governance and all the ill-treatment they are making to Burundians. They are quite convinced that they cannot win, so they want a so-called democratic election without any competition. That's why they are doing this. But I assure you, there is no election without CNL.
Before I let you go, sir, your removal took place when you were out of the country. Are you back already in the country, or do you think you will be allowed to return?
I must be back in Burundi. That's my motherland, and it's my right to live in my mother country. But who can say you are no longer a Burundian? And for what reason? I think that if they thought by doing so I could remain in exile, they have just gone astray themselves. I have to go back to Burundi where my family lives, and I cannot be separated with my family for just some fishy reasons of those who are ruling and who have failed to deliver properly according to the promises they gave to Burundians. That's why I must be there, because Burundians need me and I want to give my contribution.
Agathon Raza is the leader of Burundi's main opposition National Freedom Council Party. He was speaking with us from Nairobi, Kenya. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 13th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The East African Legislative Assembly has launched an investigation into corruption and the mismanagement of funds that involves the East African Community Secretary General Peter Matuki. This comes after the Regional Assembly recalled him last week after accusing him of mismanagement. Mose Javier Rimana reports from Nairobi.
The East African Legislative Assembly on Tuesday authorized the probe against the Secretary General of the East African Community, Peter Matuki, after accusing him of misappropriating $6 million worth of peace funds and other corrupt practices. The Regional Assembly Speaker, Joseph Nakirutimana, ordered the committee to complete investigations not later than April.
The committee to utilize its powers under the treaty and the rules to conduct credible investigations and report at the next plenary.
The Secretary General Peter Matuki took office in 2021 for a five-year term, but last week, after the accusations, Kenya's President William Ruto recalled him and nominated Matuki to be Kenya's ambassador to Russia pending the National Parliament's approval. Dennis Namara is a regional lawmaker from Uganda and the chairman of the committee in charge of appropriating funds within the East African Community.
We are coming for all of them. They should get ready. We cannot allow any cent of the community to be misappropriated. Our people are suffering with coming up with this budget. We shall take it to the President of Kenya, where he comes from, for the agencies within Kenya to handle him according to the national laws.
When contacted, the East African Community Secretary General in a written statement denied the allegations against him. He says that at no point did the Council of Ministers question him about appropriation of funds. Shahbal Suleiman is a regional lawmaker from Kenya.
I see no point to hang a man who's already been crucified. This matter was brought to the attention of His Excellency the President of the Republic of Kenya and he acted immediately and decisively. And for you Christians, I refer you to what Jesus Christ said, let he who has not sinned cast the first stone.
The East African Legislative Assembly said that the auditors will investigate and the perpetrators will be prosecuted. James Kakoza is a lawmaker from Uganda.
And that's why we are going to task the auditors to bring a political audit to prosecute whoever has been involved in this corruption.
The probe is now underway and the East African heads of state are expected to conduct an extraordinary summit to appoint and swear in a new Secretary General from Kenya to serve the remaining 2 years. Moses Avyarimana, VOA Africa, Nairobi.
Turkey's new naval agreement with Somalia places the Turkish Navy in a strategically vital region, underlining Ankara's growing naval ambitions. However, analysts warn that the agreement threatens to escalate current tensions with Somalia's neighbor, Ethiopia. Dorinya Jones reports from Istanbul.
Somali parliament ratified a 10-year defense agreement with Turkey this month. Under the deal, the Turkish Navy will help protect Somalia's territorial waters and facilitate the training and equipping of the Somali Navy. With Turkey already having a military base in Somalia, naval analysts say the deal is another step in projecting Turkish influence. Elem Erice Tepecioğlu is with the African Studies Department of Ankara Social Sciences University.
This will provide Turkey an opportunity to increase its influence in the Horn of Africa, because all those external countries, Gulf countries, Western countries, even Japan has a base in Djibouti. So they are all vying to increase their involvement in the region, especially for economic purposes. So this is an opportunity for Turkey as well.
The Somali naval deal comes as Ankara rapidly expands its navy to have a so-called blue water capabilities, or the ability to operate on the oceans far from the country's home ports. Sine Özkarashahin is an independent defense analyst.
It focuses on the projection of Turkish capacity, Turkish military capacity in the maritime domain, both in protecting its own EEZs, exclusive economic zones, waters, and also helping its allies, its partners, to do the same. And as you know, like Somalia, for example, has been fighting an increasing, threat of piracy.
Turkey's deepening military ties with Somalia come as the Horn of Africa nation faces ongoing tensions with its neighbor, Ethiopia. But analysts say Ankara is well placed to contain any fallout, given its good ties with Ethiopia. Mehmet Özkan of the Turkish National Defense University.
Military cooperation, personal cooperation, and personal relations between leaders. I think these relations are pretty good. I mean, because in the region, everybody looks for a sort of security cooperation, and it's the same for Ethiopia.
With Turkish-made military drones being widely used by both Ethiopian and Somali militaries in their wars against insurgencies, Ankara has, until now, maintained good ties with both countries. But analysts warn Ankara needs to tread carefully given the region's volatility. Again, Elem Erice Tepecioğlu of Ankara Social Sciences University.
In the long run, this might lead to Turkey's involvement in regional conflicts. So this was what Turkey was trying to avoid in its Africa policy. It does not want to be a part of African conflicts, but it might be dragged into Africa's conflicts.
With Turkey's naval deal with Somalia, the latest step in projecting influence into one of the most volatile parts of the world, analysts say Ankara will need to continue to hone its diplomatic balancing skills. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Scores of people from communities living near wildlife in Botswana marched on Tuesday against an anti-hunting bill presented to Britain's House of Commons. The protesters deliver a petition to the British High Commission as Botswana prepares to send a delegation to the UK to lobby against the bill. Nkudisi Dube reports from Haburuni.
The Hunting Trophies Import Prohibition Bill, which goes for a second reading later this month, seeks to ban the importation of legally obtained wildlife trophies from Africa. Trophy hunting is the practice of killing large animals, such as elephants, lions, and tigers for sport. Hunters often keep the heads or other parts of the animals for display. One of the organizers of the march, Bonnie Soshamukuni, says if the measure passes, it will negatively impact livelihoods of communities living side by side with wildlife in Botswana. The African nation, for example, has the world's largest elephant population at more than 130,000, and the giant animals are often in conflict with humans.
We implore your government to carefully consider implications of enacting the Hunting Trophy Import Prohibition Bill. Such a decision could have far-reaching negative consequences on rather exacerbate human wildlife conflict, undermine conservation efforts, impact the livelihoods and well-being of communities residing in wildlife areas.
Shamukuni says Botswana's wildlife numbers are stable, and reintroducing the hunting ban could lead to a rise in poaching, as previously witnessed. Botswana, under former President Ian Khama, placed a moratorium on hunting in 2014. The ban was lifted by his successor Mokgweetsi Masisi in 2019. European nations are now pushing for a ban on trophy hunting, arguing it poses a threat to wildlife populations. Last September in the UK, the House of Lords blocked the anti-hunting bill after it had moved easily through the House of Commons. Amy Dickman, a professor of wildlife conservation at the University of Oxford, says lobbying groups pushing for the hunting ban have misled the British Parliament.
They've suggested these bans will help reduce wildlife extinction, for example. They've said that bans won't undermine the livelihoods of local communities. So all of these things can be and should be rebutted with really robust evidence that does exist, showing that it's a complicated topic, it's site-specific, but actually trophy hunting is not driving the extinction of any species we can find, and that it does contribute, often importantly, to local community revenues and to the maintenance of things like protected areas and the funding of addressing major threats such as anti-poaching and habitat loss.
During Botswana's hunting season, which runs from April to September, mostly international hunters pay up to $50,000 to hunt species like elephants. They are only allowed to hunt aging males so as not to affect the breeding of the species. Local conservationist may Ives calls for an approach other than hunting.
I'm of the opinion that we should be starting to look at wildlife and, of course, natural ecosystems as something that supports all life on Earth, including that of humans. I often feel that the phrase, it pays, it stays, is a kind of slogan for almost a form of eco-blackmail. In other words, if it doesn't support humans, then it's going to die.
Currently, Botswana issues about 300 elephant hunting licenses per year. Botswana's communities earned $3 million from last year's hunting season, which, among others, is used for conservation programs. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
And that's it for this Wednesday, March 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. You can have with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barthe in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.
bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices. Our voices. Right here on VOA on Wednesdays at 19.